Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Alan Saunders, and this is By Design. Today, why don't we have more urban forests in this country? Wouldn't that make for a cooler, healthier environment? What does the architecture of Brisbane owe to California? And we dip our lids to an award-winning house in the mountains. There's quite a lot of modernism in today's show, and we begin with a very ambitious exhibition that's about to open at the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney. Modern Times, the untold story of modernism in Australia, reveals how modernism transformed all aspects of Australian culture from 1917 to 1967. It touched most aspects of our lives, from art and architecture to advertising and fashion. It reshaped our cities and transformed urban culture. And to discuss the impact of modernism, I'm joined now by the Powerhouse Museum curator, Anne Stephen. Anne, welcome to the Thoroughly Modern by Design.
Thank you, Alan.
And when we've spoken about modernism on this program before, we tended to do it in the context of architecture, but in this exhibition you've deliberately set out to look at modernism in very much wider terms than these, haven't you?
Yeah, look, 5 years ago, with the architectural historian Philip Goad and the art historian Andrew McNamara, I began to try and rethink and rewrite an account of modernism, as we put it, the untold story, really out of a frustration with the kind of insular style-based histories that have tended to cast Australian culture as dependent, dogged by a kind of time lag. And how we thought of recasting it was in terms of an interdisciplinary approach to look across both art, design and architecture, as well as, you've mentioned, film, fashion, graphic design, all those range of disciplines. Because really, the early moderns in Australia themselves worked across, you know, tended very much more to work across those disparate fields.
And in fact, you begin with the body.
We do indeed. I mean, in a way, for the exhibition, I've used a very broad and inclusive definition of modernism, one, you know, that isn't based on style, you know, compared to, say, Art Deco, but one that is about a new vision. Essentially, we're looking at the transformation of Australian culture from, you know, the British origins, from pastoral allegiances to one that is far more urban, one that is cosmopolitan. And you mentioned the body, and the exhibition does open on or place the viewer, the visitor, right in the midst of a range of different types of modern bodies. From the wonderful 1926 Miss Australia competition through to right on the beach, and that's the quintessential Australian site, if you like, with Max Dupain, Sunbaker.
Now, you've talked about the tendency when we think of modernism towards an insular view of things, but given Australia's relative geographic isolation, you would expect that between the two wars, when these ideas were transforming European and American cities, Australia would have been isolated from what was going on. So immigration, the immigration into this country of some of the creators, some of the formative players here, would have played an important part in bringing these ideas to Australia.
No, that's quite true. And migrants, refugees, exiles all form a crucial part of this, of our story, from, you know, radical Italians like Claudia Al Corso, the textile manufacturer, Nibby, who set up Leonardo's bookshop in Melbourne in the 1920s. But really the major shift came with refugees who fled Nazi Germany, Athel Smith, Wolfgang Sievers, Leonard Adam, the anthropologist, Eleanor Lang, Carl and Gertrude Langer, the Brisbane-based architect and art theorist. And, of course, the Bauhaus is represented in our show by the extraordinarily interesting artist and teacher, Hirschfeld Mack, and in the second generation, Harry Seidler, who was really schooled by Bauhaus masters Gropius, Breuer, Joseph Alberts.
If we think of the building types that typified modernity in the post-World War II world, we might think of the bowling alley, the drive-in cinema, the motel. But you'd also think of the skyscraper. And in fact, Australian cities were relatively late, weren't they, when it came to turning their eyes skywards.
That's true. There's a fascinating painting by the Melbourne painter Peter Perv Smith, which is called New York, painted in 1936 when he was on a trip to New York. He'd just seen at the Museum of Modern Art a great show on Dada and Surrealism, and he represents Manhattan as this Gotham City, which, you know, you see the skyline of the Chrysler Building, but you also see the kind of fears and phobia that Australians had to the high rise. There's this surreal, strange landscape in the foreground. And in fact, you're quite right in terms of the late arrival of the skyscraper. In fact, it was the height limit for Melbourne. High-rise really was a little earlier than Sydney, 1955, the limit of 150 feet or 45 metres was overturned. And then 2 years later, you know, with lots of struggle led by architects, it was overturned. So that's 57 in Sydney.
And you've already mentioned Harry Seidler, and it was a building of his, Australia Square in Sydney, which has... Sydneysiders will know is actually round, not square. But the Australia Square, this is a tower, that really marked Sydney's certainly coming of age as a modern city, didn't it?
Yeah, there's a great postcard. I mean, it's not one of Dupain's wonderful modernist photos that Seidler's work was generally represented by, but there's a popular postcard which we reproduced in our book on modern times, where you see Australia Square just literally towering over this otherwise very flat-looking city of the 1930s. And I think the other thing about the skyscraper is the sense in which, with Australia Square, it was the way in which Seidler was able to change the streetscape of the city by the Australia Square was the amalgamation of 30 properties and a couple of laneways in the centre of the city. And so creating a tall tower, he was able to use that the land between Pitt Street and George Street, which is the main city street, to open up new public spaces, or several plazas, and to use those spaces for, you know, major public art, like the Calder that is on George Street.
And further increasing the loss of Sydney's laneways, but that's another story. On ABC Radio National, you're with By Design. I'm talking to Anne Stephen, curator of an exhibition called Modern Times, The Untold Story of Modernism in Australia, that's about to open at the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney. Getting back and closer to ground level, one of the buildings that seems to encapsulate the promised future offered to us by modernism is the Academy of Science building in Canberra, that wonderful dome by Roy Grounds. That has a very space age feeling to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, from the outset, it was called, amongst other names, the Martian Embassy.
Yes.
And I think the idea of scientists meeting together within its chamber was very much an idea of the allocation of science at the very centre of the Australia, the forward-looking new Australia. And it's quite, I mean, the chamber itself was has furniture by Fred Ward, wonderful éclaté fabrics. The interior design was, in fact, by Roy Grounds' wife, Bettina Grounds. And we show in the exhibition the construction of the dome in a wonderful little film that was made by someone who was working on the site. And right at the end of the film, you see Robert Menzies, then Prime Minister, opening the dome. And it's quite ironic that 20 years before, he was at the forefront of an attempt to introduce the Academy of Art, an anti-modern move, and there he is, 1959, launching the Academy of Sciences in the most modern of buildings.
Ah, well, if you're Prime Minister, you have to go with the flow sometimes. If we look at retail architecture, what can we learn about Australian modernism from pubs and cafes?
Well, I think that it was in the commercial sphere that modernism was first really embraced. And you have, you know, really from the 1930s, milk bars in working class suburbs like Port Kembla. There's a wonderful modern Black Cat down there. At the same time, you have in the heart of Collins Street, Roy Grounds opening absolutely state-of-the-art Milky Way, which had stainless steel tubular furniture just the same as the bar house was producing. Right through to the 1950s, where you get in Melbourne to mark, really to coincide with the Olympic Games, the brilliant designer, later artist, Clement Meadmore, doing the Legend Cafe, in which he collaborates with the artist Len French, who does a series of murals. He uses primary coloured fiberglass for his chairs. He has terrazzo floor and wonderful fluoro ceiling. So just absolutely state of the art.
Just coming up to the end of the period covered by your exhibition, how did Australia portray itself as a modern country at Expo 67 in Montreal?
Well, the external pavilion was designed by a government architect. The interior was a collaboration between Robin Boyd and Grant Featherstone. And Mary Featherstone, who had married Grant a year or two earlier, was working with him on the wonderful Expo sound chairs, which literally, you sat in these kind of cocoon-like chairs, and you heard from the speakers stories, whether it was Googie Withers on theatre or Menzies on industrial development. You heard stories of Australia. Now, the whole interior was designed like a living room. And there's, in fact, a petty cartoon which takes the Featherstone chair but suggests that there are other realities entering the living room via the TV, and he has images of Vietnam coming out of the TV.
I love the idea of Bob Menzies talking to me when I sit on a chair. pardon me. And the exhibition opens on August the 8th, and it runs until February next year at Sydney's Powerhouse Museum. And, Stephen, it does, however, travel, doesn't it? And you also have a symposium coming up.
Yeah, the symposium looks at how modernism commands a powerful influence today on 20th century culture. That's on next Friday at the Powerhouse. And we have, in fact, Bob Woodward, the architect, designer of the fountain at El Alamein, and Mary Featherston.
And the exhibition is moving, is travelling to Brisbane and Melbourne next year.
Yeah, it'll be at Heidi in Melbourne, and it'll be at the State Library Queensland next year.
And Stephen, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up on By Design, an award-winning house and what the architecture of Queensland owes to California. But next, trends and products. This week in Trends and Products, we're joined by the physicist Dr. Peter Fisher, who emailed us in response to our conversation in June with Melbourne City Council's Rob Adams. Dr. Fisher is a climate change consultant and research fellow at Central Queensland University. He's an enthusiast for old-fashioned shade, the shade of trees and plants, and he's lobbying hard for urban forests. Peter Fisher, welcome to By Design.
Yes, good morning, Alan.
Good morning. And, well, basic question, what exactly is an urban forest?
Well, it's a US term, North American term. They're pretty keen on it, but it's not been used here in general. We used to call it green space, but it's basically the canopies, the trees, and all the veg under the trees. And, in fact, if you think about our cities, if you, for example, look from the Rialto Tower in Melbourne to the east, you'll see a nothing but a forest of trees. If you stand on the top of the Sydney Harbour Bridge and look north, you'll see the same. In Brisbane, you'll see it all over the city, and you get a kind of a tropical variant in places like Darwin and Broome. So it's the green infrastructure, which is kind of over the page when we're talking about infrastructure for our cities.
Well, you're able to point to examples, as you just have, of green infrastructure in Australia, but it's a relatively undeveloped idea here, isn't it?
I mean, it is. That's true. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I gather there's a Lend-Lease building in Sydney that's an example.
A roof garden. Yep.
But the lead's really been taken by Germany and by the mayor of Boston, hasn't it?
Yes, that's right. The mayor of Boston has been very keen on this after the incident of heat waves, where it's recognised that the trees can in fact save something like 4 degrees in temperature rise. And that's an enormous benefit when you look at air conditioning and things like that. But the North Americans are really hooked on it. In fact, there's the Canadian Urban Forest Network, and they're saying that 24 million Canadians live in their urban forests. So it's something which hasn't been articulated here. And when I heard the discussion back in June, it struck me that the discussion about urban areas isn't just about the hard elements, but the if you like, our cities are soft-wired with vegetation as well.
Well, the discussion in June, one of the things that Rob Adams talked about was that we should have solar panels on our rooftops, which would greatly decrease our carbon footprint. And you think there are problems with that, don't you?
Well, look, there are a lot of trade-offs to be made with urban forests and trees and so forth. We know about the sort of threats and the notoriety some of these trees have. I mean, there's some suggestion that trees in high winds are called widow makers. You know, they fall on houses and so forth. But there are quite a few elements which... I've lost the track of your question.
Solar panels are not the end of are not the solution to all our problems.
They're because of using solar panels next to houses which have large trees. So what do you do? Do you save on energy by shading, or do you generate energy by exposing your hard surfaces to solar panels? So they're the sort of conflicts that you have. You have also conflicts between native versus exotic vegetation in Australia. So if you really want to get maximum light penetration in winter, and therefore warmth of the sun, you generally need exotic trees. That's deciduous trees.
Well, I want to come on in a moment to the particular sorts of trees that we might need.
Yep.
But let's also talk about numbers. This is about strategic plantings across the city.
Yep.
But what about the numbers of trees that we need to make it work effectively?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. The United States has got something like 43,000 square miles. Sorry, I haven't got the conversion to square kilometres of hard surfaces, hard paved surfaces, basically for car parks, roads, aprons and so forth. That's equivalent to the area of Ohio State. So in order to compensate for those impervious surfaces, that's code for hard surfaces, you need to, in fact, increase your vegetation by 2, sometimes 4 and even 10 to reduce the degree of runoff, because you have enormous problems when you get storms, you have hard surfaces and you get heat island effects as well. And then you've got the carbon sequestration element. It's estimated that in inner Melbourne there's something like 1 million tonnes of carbon sequestered in 100,000 trees. So what's unique about this urban forest is it's both at one stage a climate change mitigate, if you like, and it's also a means for abating the impacts of climate change.
On ABC Radio National, I'm Alan Saunders, and with me this morning, I've been joined by Dr. Peter Fisher, a physicist, lobbying for old-fashioned shade and calling for us to consider the concept of an urban forest. Peter, a lot of this is about water conservation. The dry seasons that Australia has been experiencing over the last couple of decades have seen a number of trees die. And I think you estimate there's something like, this is an amazing figure, 15% of trees in Melbourne have died from lack of water.
That's right. That was the original prompt from this research. It was seeing that trees literally fall over, and that was happening right across Australia. It's been relieved to some extent by the rainfall in Brisbane and in Sydney. But basically what we're looking at in that urban forest is a relic structure of nature, if you like. Well, it's a contrived structure, just like the Greenland ice sheet is a relic of the last ice age. I believe that this relic urban forest, that is a forest which has been planted 20 or 30 years ago or more during a different climatic regime when there was much more higher rainfall, I believe we won't get that back. We won't be able to grow trees to the same statures we've done in the past. And that's why it's critical that we need to maintain this urban forest to protect it from the threats of high winds and droughts and even development at some points.
Well, let's look at the sort of trees that we need, trees that perhaps can survive without watering. I gather that this means Australian native trees primed to survive in cities, which can be very tough and unforgiving environments for plants, can't they?
Yes, they can be. I mean, they're subject, among other things, to compaction from cars and walking on surfaces and so forth. One of the things that our group is looking at is a drought rating for various Australian trees so that the consumers, the public, will have some indication of what they should plant. We need to be able to grow trees which will, in fact, grow quickly and produce the sort of benefits we're talking about. But as we move more into the climatic change regime, we need to look at the sort of trees which would be able to cope with increasing heat, pests, and high winds. One of the ironies is when you get downpours of rain, you get this sort of effect and then you have the high winds, the trees fall over.
Yeah. Can you talk species here? What are we talking about?
Well, this is still in the land of conceptualization, so I'm not quite sure as to what species we would select. That needs to be researched.
Now, you mentioned high winds. Yeah. Presumably trees, assuming they can survive the high winds, could also play a role in protecting us from the winds that drive through modern cities.
Yes, we need to look very closely at that, because we do sometimes get a domino effect when a tree is removed. You might have noticed if your neighbour removes a tree, then maybe your tree will blow over because it's buffering it. So we need to also look at the way we can plant trees in such a way that we can get the benefits of protecting structures from wind, at the same time avoiding the trees becoming a hazard with limb fall and so forth. So there's quite an issue there. In fact, some tree managers, in inverted commas, in our cities are going around knocking on doors, suggesting to people that their tree could be a hazard. It could fall on the neighbour's car and so forth. So there is a bit of an anti-tree move. They are hazardous and litigious.
So what can we do? What can the By Design listener do, apart from standing up to tree managers, to encourage more urban forests? Should we get rid of the minimalist garden, for example?
Yes, indeed. In fact, I looked at one the other day and I was appalled. You know, houses on very small blocks and lots of hard surfaces, pebbles, yuccas, and these will become an extraordinary heat island, so we need to maintain our veg. The irony is the water restrictions in our capital cities have in fact reduced the viability of some of these large trees. And you can do a calculation, which is rather extraordinary. Something like 30 kilowatt hours per year is saved per shade tree in terms of air conditioning. For every kilowatt hour you generate at a power station, you use 95 litres of water. So if you put all that together, you get this counterintuitive effect that, in fact, maintaining the urban forest will save water back at the power station, which is water can be used for other purposes.
Well, that's a cheering thought to end on. Peter Fisher, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Peter is a research fellow at Central Queensland University. We'd love to hear from you about the right species of tree for the concept of an urban forest to withstand the harsh environment of the city. So you can contact us and you can find details of Peter's work on our website at abc.net.au/rn/bydesign. And now time for Your Say, where you get a chance to share with us your thoughts and ideas. And today, Michael Penk emails in response to our interview last week about Buckminster Fuller, the inventor of the geodesic dome. It was interesting to hear about Fuller again. I was privileged to listen to him lecture at my design school some time ago. We, or better Australia, has its own exhibition of Fuller in the form of the beautiful shapes of Pine Gap, the dreaded listening posts of the USA. These domes are, since the late 60s, all over the world. And regular listener and correspondent Judy Sublett writes in response to our conversation with Rob Adams from Melbourne City Council, Rob Adams's reference to traffic management is the first time I've heard someone sensible on the topic. All the time they are narrowing our streets, creating obstacles such as median strips, roundabouts, road closures, allowing massive tram stops in the city to take up half our brilliantly designed wide roads, and then funneling all traffic onto freeways and tollways, which they then complain are inadequate. If the argument is safety on residential streets, when was the last time you saw a child on the street anyway? They're all being ferried to creches or school in cars. Let's deal with the world as it is, not as we would like it to be. There should be more on-street parking, not less. There should be more streets opened up, not less. Anyone who thinks we can do without cars is out of their mind. Well, that's not an opinion we hear often on this show, so it's good to hear that alternative view. And this might be a good time to tell you that you can listen to today's show again, and in fact to any by design, for 1 month after broadcast date, and you can do this by downloading a podcast or listening at your computer with audio on demand.
From politics to poetry, religion, science and the arts, every day, brilliant people are talking about fascinating things. ABC4 is a new TV program on ABC2, bringing you the best of public talks, debates and discussions, and accompanied by a comprehensive and dynamic website, abc.net.au/fora. I'm Tony Jones. Join me on Thursday afternoons at 5:35 and again on Friday mornings at 8 for ABC4 on ABC2 and online.
And now, By Design's Jan Ryan is on location with the architect James Stockwell, who's just won the 2008 Wilkinson Award, the Royal Australian Institute of Architects' top award for a domestic house in New South Wales. This house is in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, in Leura. James Stockwell is one of Australia's leading young architects. He now has his own practice in Sydney, and he was a member of Peter Stutchbury's team when they won the Robin Boyd Award, the top national prize for domestic architecture. Here's James Stockwell with Jan Ryan.
Where's the most passionate, most exciting part of this house for you?
I think it's where we're standing, because the room's quite dynamic from the point of view of how much you can change its qualities. We're standing in front of a veranda where half of the roof opens up to allow the winter sun in to heat the floor, and it changes the light quality in the room a lot.
Now, really, this, I suppose, for the listener, this is a lounge room, has a fireplace and underfloor heating, but big glass windows looking out over the front garden and over the valley.
A very simple formula on this site was to say, well, we're facing north, that's where all our heat's coming from and all our light, we should open up to it, make a cave-like room, very simply from beautiful natural materials, in this case rammed sandstone, costs 320 a square metre and you've got...
Is that cheap?
That's cheap for walls, yeah, for external walls.
And is that from the Blue Mountains here, local sandstone?
Local sandstone quarry. It's actually the cheapest thing you can buy from a quarry. And it glows because of the quartz content in the rammed earth. So,
well, listeners can actually see images of the building, and you'll get images of the rammed sandstone.
Yeah, people call it rammed earth.
Well, you can see those images on abc.net.au/rn/bydesign. So this is the main part of the house, but it's a deceptively large house.
It is spread out, and that's really mainly to get north sun onto thermal mass in as much of the house as possible. So we've walked in and it's noticeably warmer and there's been no heating on.
Now, I think it's probably, what do you reckon, 6 degrees outside?
Oh, yeah, something like that. And in here we're now having warmed up a bit. I guess it's probably around 20, 21.
Yeah. Now, it's not an open plan house as you would imagine. It's very open, which is a slightly different thing to have an open house to having an open plan house. It's sort of a bit more sophisticated and a bit more layered. Was that deliberate?
It is very deliberate. The owners were keen on not having a kitchen connected to dining and living. Each part of the house can be separated off. But the way the walls and the spaces are arranged has evolved from an idea that was developed in the 1940s in Japan, and it basically means that the rooms are open-ended and you can go on a bit of a journey through the house and not be enclosed in one room. There's good connection between the house, and so two people can live in here very comfortably, or there can be, you know, 10 or 15 people and not get in each other's way.
So in a way, what you have or you don't have is conventional doors.
They are here, but you can't see them and you can separate them off. It was important to have thermal locks.
Let's hear the doors close. Can we do that, James?
Sure.
Because this is what locks these hidden doors, which lock the rooms off and essentially make them beautiful and warm and contained and very private as well.
There you go. That means the heating can be switched off in different parts of the house.
Now, the house looks over the valley at the Blue Mountains, so for people who want to imagine this house. You can imagine the Blue Mountains looking out over near the Three Sisters, the valley, the beautiful mist that we're experiencing now in winter. So it's a very compelling environment, lots of beautiful native trees as well.
There's a beautiful valley, and it's an old market garden, and so the soil quality here is very good. The owners have replanted the Eucalyptus minifera from seed collected on the site, and the young trees will grow up to match a couple of remnant ones that were on the site. So it's bringing the bird life back up into the valley and around the house.
As you mentioned, the house can close down. One person could be here and not feel overwhelmed by the house, and yet you could have 10 people staying here and not feel overwhelmed by them.
That's true. There's a TV room and library here, which has a secret door of a bookcase that moves in that corner.
Well, can we? What happens there?
There was always the idea of having a continuous bookcases around here,
yes.
And we needed access behind it. So we built a secret handle that you push in. It's a little bit like Doctor Who, and it unlocks the bookcase, which opens up, and you've got a secret
chamber. Okay, now it's opening. What is it? So secret that we?
No, it's quite boring in behind. There's not much stuff. It's not a staircase or anything, unfortunately. It's amazing to see how much children love this house, actually. So ultimately, it was really about making places that are nice to be in. The main role I saw is placemaking. And to that you think, okay, what's a good space? Somewhere the sun's coming in, somewhere that's warm, somewhere you can see out from, somewhere that's a nice scale where you feel comfortable with people, and something that makes sense to you in terms of your own history. And in this case, the history of the owners was growing up in the country in Australia and being concerned about resources and conserving resources and collecting their own water and making their own power.
So it's completely sustainable in that sense.
It is. One other realisation on this project, which I've found to be very important and worth consideration, and it's coming up a lot, is the amount of energy involved in the materials that are used in the buildings. And timber, rammed earth, very good materials to use.
Well, you've done an amazingly beautiful job. It feels so warm and inviting. Of course, another surprise is that ceilings are not as high as one would. The ceilings range in height. Is that, again, deliberate to make you feel the space differently?
The ceilings throughout the job, you'll see, are strips of plywood. And you'll notice as we're walking around, there's not a lot of reflected sound. And that is the trick of having an acoustic absorption in with polished concrete floors as we have here. Those considerations like acoustics and ventilations, warmth, they're all functional things. And they're all the bottom line, really. And if you can achieve them, 90% of your job's done, really.
Well, yeah, and it's a process of learning how to achieve it, of course. And what comes to mind when I think of that, who have you been most influenced by in your architecture career?
Interestingly enough, a firm called Future Systems in the UK are a major influence, and they come through a guy, Bill Busfield, who's a wonderful teacher. And that really is about the beauty inherent in simple structural answers to things, in nature mainly. Utzon was a great proponent of this. It doesn't try and depart too much from building on the past and in incremental improvements in things. Like, everyone loves verandas, and so in this case the veranda was there, but new questions were asked of it, like, how do you get light into the house? So is normally verandas cut off all the light. And so this case, the pivot's in the middle, and it's simple farm technology. I grew up on a farm, and you muck around with metal and do welding and all of that sort of thing for years in the younger days. And so you have a feeling for how simply things can be done.
Now it's really starting to rain.
It is. The mountains weather. Yeah. Kicking in.
I guess what an architect needs and a client needs, you know, you share a common goal, but you need the huge kind of leap of faith where you just jump off and you go on this incredible journey, because this is going to be their house, but they also want something more than that, don't they? A client wouldn't engage an architect if they didn't want to engage in a conversation, they didn't want to engage in learning, and they didn't want to engage in bringing kind of better possibilities to our lives.
It's true, and I've often tried to put myself in the shoes of a client and think, gosh, it is a real act of faith and trust. I have a firm belief that good ideas don't necessarily cost more. And in fact, the better the idea is, in fact, you can work out innovations that mean things can cost less. And the test for a designer is, and you know when you've had a good idea because it's solved four problems with one move.
Well, let's go on a bit of a walk.
We're in the first bedroom and it's all plywood walls, hoop pine plywood.
And ceiling.
And ceiling. And so it's one
and
material.
Cupboards.
And cupboards. And the
and door. Double glaze, so yeah, it's holding the energy runs in.
And
a little bit of glass into the hallway for the light.
A little bit of glass up the top, which means the western sun as it's setting sneaks in.
Oh, a lovely little surprise.
So as you're thinking the day's over, you get this little beam of light which will come through just under the ceiling. Instead of having fly screens over openings, I've got these little vents that open up just under the ceiling. They're about 300 millimetres deep, and they're just on little...
Okay, so
shutters,
you just pull them open, yeah.
Little hydraulic gas rams, like on the back of your car.
You're right, it's just like opening the back of the car door.
Boot. Pretty robust and agricultural. So all the materials, again, are the same, and sometimes you think, gosh, it's all the same, and, oh, no, you know, you're using too much of one material. But I've realised through observing the work of architects like Zumthor, Peter Zumthor, who's a Swiss architect, simple palette makes things clear, easy to build because things are repetitive.
And the rooms repeat.
So these
themselves.
Are three yeah. rooms here, and they flow out to this one, which is this. And they all sit on a podium of rammed earth and sandstone. But we're standing here about knee height above a games lawn. The building just sort of wanders around the edge of this terrace and creates the space in an overall L shape, but no handrails were needed. And so you get a feeling of elevation and able to see down the valley. It's a really funny balance, that thing of risk, I find, in architecture. You want to give people the excitement of being on it at an edge.
Yeah.
So there's a counterpoint there of getting the invigoration that you can achieve from connecting with the sense of being in charge of yourself.
Being safe but exhilarated.
Yeah, so you're yes. really feel like you're controlling your own destiny if you're controlling your own risk.
James Stockwell controlling his own risk with By Design's Jan Ryan. James has just won the Wilkinson Award, the top architectural award for a house in New South Wales. Details on our website, abc.net.au/rn/bydesign, which is also where you can go for a web slideshow of the Blue Mountains house. Coming up next on By Design, California Dreaming in Queensland. And first, some California music from John Williams' score for Robert Altman's, I think, much underrated screen version of The Long Goodbye by that most LA of authors, Raymond Chandler. That has elements of a California nightmare in it. Lazy but slightly threatening. But let's turn from nightmares to dreams. California Dreaming is the title of a paper written by my next guest, Andrew Wilson. It affords a wonderful insight into the development of the modern Australian house and the inspiration that many architects, particularly those in post-war Queensland, drew from American and also British architectural magazines and museum shows. Andrew Wilson's a lecturer in architecture at the University of Queensland, and his essay is part of the catalogue for a show opening today at the Gallery of Modern Art in Brisbane and called Placemakers, Contemporary Queensland Architects. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning, Alan.
Now, California Dreaming, the title of your paper, California really did play a big role in the development of architecture in Queensland. What were the key ideas?
Well, I think in the 1940s in Queensland, there was a strong interest in California, particularly the work of the architect William Worster. And I think what architects in Queensland were particularly interested in was the way that Worster worked very equivalently with landscape architects. For example, he worked with the landscape architect Thomas Church, and I think architects in this part of the world saw this as very interesting.
And it was not the first appearance of California in Australian architecture. I mean, the California bungalow in the pre-war years was already a feature of Australian life in cities like Canberra, for example.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's true. I think what one of the things I draw out in my essay is the work of Karl Langer, the Austrian emigre architect that Anne Stephen mentioned a bit earlier. He arrived in Brisbane in 1940. He was obviously one of those emigre architects fleeing the annexation of Austria. And he arrived in Brisbane in 1940 with his wife, Gertrude. Partly they arrived in Sydney and he couldn't find any work here. And I think he was able to find some work with Kerrison and Cook. And he ended up being a part-time lecturer at the University of Queensland. But he principally lectured in the area of garden design. And in the middle of the war, in 1942-43, the university pretty much shut down. And I think during this time, he was given the job of working up a paper on what was called subtropical housing. And the paper dealt with two aspects. It was like a prototype of architectural science information bundled up with some prototype plans. And I think when Langer was working up these plans, he was looking very closely at the work of another Austrian emigre architect, Rudolf Schindler, who had moved to California in the 20s and built his own house over 1921-22.
And Karl Langer's wife, Gertrude, was influential as well, wasn't she? Because she became a critic for the Daily Press.
Well, absolutely. Karl met Gertrude doing art history in Austria and in Vienna. And when they emigrated here, I guess there was some suspicion about them for a long time, given their German language background. But by about 1953, I think Gertrude had been appointed as an art critic for the Courier Mail, and she was in that position for about 30 years and very influential on art criticism in this part of the world.
Does the Courier Mail have an architecture critic these days? I bet it doesn't, does it?
Not that I'm aware of. I think Rex Butler has been... Rex Butler, the art historian, has written pieces for the Courier Mail.
But as well as Gertrude Langer's work, the architectural press and the USA's Art and Architecture in particular, and also the British magazine, the Architectural Review, were very, very influential, weren't they?
I think they were. Langer at the University of Queensland taught Campbell Scott, and he also taught Robert Froud, and both these architects went on to form practices that after the war did design houses with a strong Californian influence. And they were looking at magazines like Arts and Architecture, the magazine that in 1945 launched the Case Study House program. And you see in some of their projects, particularly projects built in Surface Paradise, direct explicit reference to motifs from the Case Study House program.
Well, let's turn to the Case Study House. In the 1945 Art and Architecture, published in Los Angeles, edited by John Entenza, the Case Study House first appeared, as I said, in 1945. What was important about this program?
Well, I think there's a number of things. I think it represented a kind of idea of a certain kind of lifestyle. And I think one of the reasons why that lifestyle had a lot of agency in Queensland was there was a kind of move to thinking about development of the Gold Coast and the North Coast as kinds of holiday destinations and ultimately the cities in their own right. And so I think there was, given this sort of the beach aspect of Los Angeles and the kind of mass production possibilities that were explored and the idea of economy and efficiency, these things had a lot of appeal and were certainly ideas that Hayes and Scott were certainly very interested in their work.
And the one of the most famous of the houses in the case study program was by Charles and Ray Eames, the great American designers. But as you said, Hayes and Scott, a Brisbane-based firm, they really turned their attention to creating a local style on this basis, didn't they?
Yeah, I think that's true. I guess they were... I think we've got to remember that after the war, for a long time, there were still material restrictions in place, and there were plan size restrictions of roughly 115 square metres. So architects and builders had to work within those kind of constraints, and they also had to work within the capability of builders of the time. So Hayes and Scott remarked they were often frustrated that they wanted, for example, to build flat-roofed houses, but builders at the time weren't able to do that. And Campbell Scott's own house in St. Lucia, which is actually a very beautiful house, he was always frustrated that it ended up with a terracotta tile roof. So there were those kind of pragmatic constraints as well.
Another important innovation on post-war architecture was the influential Brazil Builds exhibition held at the Museum of Modern Art in New York in 1943. This caught the eye of James Burrell. What was it that attracted him?
Well, I think he was very interested in the exuberance of the work, and but I think if you look at photographs, say, of Brazil and architecture in its location, the another aspect is that the landscape is uncannily like a Queensland landscape. So he was, as Brisbane City Council architect, appointed in 1955 at around the age of 27. He was very quickly working on the Centenary Pools project, where he brought into play this interest in projects that have been built in Brazil and elsewhere in South America, and more or less appropriates ideas from those projects into the Centenary Pool project.
Talking about exuberance, and just finally, Andrew, paint. The new types of paint allowed for new colours to be used after World War II. Did this influence the way in which buildings were highlighted?
I think it did. Hayes and Scott are very famous for highlighting their buildings with a kind of black edging, but they also used these new colours to good effect in the composition of their buildings. So they generally were working with quite simple forms, but these simple forms were then animated with some of the new colours that were available that had been developed out of the war technology.
Well, Andrew Wilson, thank you very much for joining By Design this morning.
Pleasure.
The details of Andrew's essay, California Dreaming, are on our website, abc.net.au/rn/bydesign. And the show, Placemakers, Contemporary Queensland Architects, opens today at the Gallery of Modern Art in Brisbane. And if you want to share with us your views on modernism, urban forests, or anything else on this week's show, you can write to us by going to our website, and that's also where to go for details of our podcasts. The show is produced by Mark Wakely and Jan Ryan, with technical production this week by Timothy Nicastri. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with another By Design.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.